This is the fourth tape in a series by Robert J. Dunsweiler, Associate Professor of Systematic Theology and Apologetics at Biblical Theological Seminary.
A brief look at the history of spiritualism. I met a friend of mine out in the hall just before this class, and I was speaking with him and telling him about this sensational type of course that we were dealing with here. And I pointed out that there are two dangers which I was trying to avoid in this course. One, I was trying to keep consciously aware of the danger of having some individuals who could become obsessed with this area of the occult, so that it became so much a part of their thinking and their world that they could think of scarcely anything else. I wanted to avoid that danger. The other danger I wanted to avoid was the danger of presenting, when we got to the historical sections of spiritualism and witchcraft in particular, the danger of dwelling on the lurid, dwelling on the kinds of things which would be more destructive than constructive. I want to present the truth about it, but I don't want to dwell on the things which would really be harmful to people. So, here we go. Brief look at the history of spiritualism. Emanuel Swedenborg, 1688 to 1772. Those are not page numbers, those are his dates. Emanuel Swedenborg is considered a forerunner of spiritualism. Swedenborg was a scientist, an engineer, a philosopher, a poet, and a member of the Swedish Parliament. Swedenborg was no insignificant personage. At the age of 56, he announced that God has opened his eyes and had allowed him to enter the realm of spirits and angels. He claimed that in dreams, and then even afterward in waking visions, not just in dreams, but in visions which he had while he was awake, he wandered in the next world, where he was instructed by the spirits of kings, popes, saints, and biblical personages. He described the afterlife as being very similar to this life, rather than different as Christian theology had described it. He devoted the rest of his life to the writing of 12 books about his continuing visions, and also he devoted his life to the founding of the Swedenborgian Church, which is called the Church of the New Jerusalem. This church is represented here in the United States by the Bryn Athyn Cathedral. There's a beautiful cathedral there. It is beautiful. And they have guided tours. They'll take you around free. And also with the cathedral, there is the Academy of the New Church, which has a high school level, it has a college level, and it has a theological school level. So it's a little more influential than the numbers would lead you to believe. His most famous work is Arcana Celestia, which is simply translated Celestial Mysteries. Several of the main strands of contemporary occult beliefs can be traced right back to Swedenborg's views and the claims which he made in his writings. So he is considered a forerunner of spiritualism. Another forerunner of spiritualism was Andrew Jackson Davis. Davis was an apprentice shoemaker, and he discovered, I don't know exactly how he came to this discovery, but he discovered that he could induce trance states in himself. He could go into trances. At the age of 18, he tells us, he went into a semi-trance, and he wandered in this semi-trance state from his home in Poughkeepsie, New York, And the next morning, he found himself 40 miles away in the mountains. He claimed that in the mountains he met the spirits of Emanuel Swedenborg and a second century Greek physician, Claudius Galen, which spirits illuminated his mind. He began dictating books while he was in trance. He went into trance and he dictated books, which were copied down by a friendly clergyman. He then married a socialite wife. He acquired his own publishing company. He issued books and magazines, and he acquired a rather influential following. He was even called the Seer of Poughkeepsie. He predicted that the truth of spiritual communication with the dead would soon be revealed. And this prediction became widely spread, widely known, not only through his own literature, but through various news stories that were picked up and spread. On March 31st, 1848, the most important single date in the history of spiritualism, March 31st, 1848, in a cottage in Hydesville, New York, three sisters began to fulfill this prediction. For the past several nights before March 31st, strange rapping noises had awakened their parents, John and Margaret Fox. On that night, March 31st, their daughters, Kate, age 7, and Margaret, age 10, called on an invisible Mr. Splitfoot to answer some simple questions which they posed for him. They were counting questions. Kate clapped her hands a certain number of times and then stopped, and the same number of raps was heard. Margaret said, "Count 1, 2, 3, 4. And four raps were heard. 1, 2, 3, 4. These mysterious rappings heralded the birth of spiritualism. When young Margaret Fox went to Rochester, New York, the following year to stay with her sister, Leah Fox Fish, who was married, and she was much older. She was 34 years old, and young Margaret was then just 11. Leah, her older sister, discovered that she too could communicate with the spirits, and she could conduct seances that the public could attend for a fee. Interest reached such a pitch that the citizens of Rochester said that they had to investigate these phenomena. And so they called a meeting, which took place at Corinthian Hall in Rochester, New York, on November 14th, 1849. They could find no explanation for the strange rapping noises which the sisters produced, Leah and Margaret. Two other committees then investigated the two sisters, but they were completely mystified. The sisters would ask the spirits, quote-unquote, questions, and the spirits would answer with rappings, rapping noises. And then the sisters caught on to the idea. They placed an alphabet before them, and then they would ask questions, and they would point to the letter of the alphabet. They'd go through the whole alphabet in order. And when they came to the right letter, the spirits would rap, and then they would write down that letter. And then they would start through again, and the spirit or spirits would rap again at a certain letter, and they'd write that letter down. And after a while, they would read off a whole message from the spirits, which the spirits had communicated simply through rapping. Well, These two committees could find no explanation for this, and they were absolutely mystified. By the year 1850, Leah took both Kate and Margaret on a tour of seances and public appearances to various cities and towns. They went to Albany, they went to Troy, they went to Buffalo, and then they came to New York City. During these seances, messages were spelled out, tables rocked, objects moved in the room, guitars seemingly played themselves, played songs, and sitters at the seances felt the touch of invisible hands. Horace Greeley, the influential editor of the New York Tribune, came for a sitting in 1850. He was very curious and wanted to investigate as a newsman. He wanted to investigate this fantastically fascinating phenomenon, and he later wrote these words, "Whatever may be the origin or cause of the rappings, the ladies in whose presence they occur do not make them. We tested this thoroughly and to our entire satisfaction." So Horace Greeley gave his great weight of authority and prestige to the alleged reality of these rappings as coming from discarnates, from spirits. Following these tours and these testimonials, converts to spiritualism began joining the ranks almost daily. Mediums began to spring up everywhere. And throughout the country, various people found that they could produce raps and table tappings in their own homes. In fact, within 2 years, materialized ghosts and flying furniture were familiar events at these seances in many places. In 1853, the first spiritualist church in England was established in Yorkshire, in a town called Keighley. In 1854, the Society for the Diffusion of Spiritual Knowledge was founded. This was America's first spiritualist organization. 1854, the Society for the Diffusion of Spiritual Knowledge. It was underwritten by a wealthy New York merchant, and the society sponsored free public sittings. The society engaged a medium to conduct the sittings, and this medium was none other than Kate Fox, one of the three Fox sisters. She was paid $1,200 a year for her services, which at that time was an enormous amount of money, $1,200 a year. But the sittings were free. In other words, they paid her, and then she gave free sittings. By 1854, spiritualism had gained such a following in the United States that 15,000 convinced spiritualists sent a petition to Congress demanding an official commission to investigate and to verify the new revelation from the spirits. 15,000 spiritualists. This is in 1854. The second spiritualistic stars, if we may call them that, were the Koons family, K-O-O-N-S, of Millfield, Ohio. First you have the Fox family, now you have the Koons family. Jonathan Koons was a farmer. One day, Jonathan Koons discovered that all eight of his children were mediums. All eight of them. They all had mediumistic powers. And under the direction of the spirits, he got a message from the spirits, under their direction, he built a log house next to his own home, a 16 by 20 foot log house, for the express purpose of holding seances. And in this log house on his own land, Night after night, remarkable things began to happen, always in the darkness. Lights flashed, spirit hands played musical instruments, and furniture floated around in the air in this 16 by 20 foot cabin. There were said to be many prominent converts to spiritualism around this time. Colonels, judges, writers, journalists, clergymen. The seances of the Fox sisters at Barnum's Hotel, that's none other than P.T., Barnum's Hotel in Manhattan, attracted such celebrities as William Cullen Bryant, the poet, James Fenimore Cooper, the novelist, and, as we've already mentioned, Horace Greeley, the editor. Now, two brothers, Ira and William Davenport, began to produce really spectacular phenomena. They performed first in the dark parlor of their Buffalo, New York home, Ira and William Davenport. After their hands had been tied together with ropes and the room darkened, guitars and other musical instruments began to play. Allegedly, of course, by spirit hands, because their hands were tied, you see. When the lights were turned back on again, their hands were still tied. They went on the road as stage mediums. That is, they went from theater to theater and they demonstrated their mediumistic abilities. They took with them a large three-door wooden enclosure which looked like a closed cabinet, three doors in the front of it. They sat on seats at opposite ends. That is, as you opened the two end doors, you could see the seats, which had been specially nailed in. And they sat on these seats. The seats had holes drilled through them, and their hands were tied behind them. The ropes were passed down through the holes in the seats, and then the ropes were tied around their feet to tie their feet together, their ankles together. So now just imagine that. The hands are tied behind them, the feet are tied together, and the ropes are passed through holes in the seat on which they were sitting. Almost as soon as the three front doors had been closed, spirit hands waved out through diamond-shaped openings in the doors, and bells, tambourines, and stringed instruments, which had been put inside the cabinet with the brothers, began to play. When the cabinet doors were opened, the hands and the feet of the brothers were still tied. The career of the Davenports, who were a great success, spanned over a half century. Over 50 years they performed. Oh, of course, they added more sophisticated elements to their act. But they claimed that they were spirit mediums. They were not magicians, they were spirit mediums. And they were showing mediumistic phenomena. During the 1860s, Kate Fox found a wealthy patron, a New York banker named Charles E. Livermore. Charles Livermore was mourning the recent death of his wife Estelle, and therefore had a great psychological desire, of course, to see her again. Kate gave 388 seances for him. And in one of these seances, Livermore saw a hazy spectral form in the room. Several nights later, a luminous globe appeared, a globe emitting light, very, very gentle light. Before the globe faded away, he briefly glimpsed in the globe his dead wife's face. Later, not simply her face, but her figure as well, her whole body materialized. One evening, Livermore said, he even stroked the spirit's hair. And he reported that it was identical with human hair. But after a brief space, it melted away, leaving nothing in his grasp. Unfortunately, as Kate Fox developed as a medium, she became an alcoholic. By the fall of 1871, Livermore felt that a complete change of scenery was necessary to save her from alcoholic self-destruction, and he sent her to England, where a distinguished British scientist, William Crookes, tested her for months to determine whether the spiritualistic phenomena. He was deeply impressed. A British spiritualist was once held by a rather personable 16-year-old medium named Florence Cook. Florence had been tied to a chair and concealed from view by an opaque curtain. So she was tied in a chair, and then a curtain was drawn between her and the sitters in the seance. As the medium went into trance behind the curtain, a spirit form draped in white came out from behind the curtain and walked among the sitters in the seance room. It was a very dimly lit room. There was only one small, very low gas jet which was supplying light. And she actually talked. The spirit form talked with the sitters. The spirit said her name was Katie King. Now, Katie King was the name of a spirit who supposedly was causing some of the phenomena in the Jonathan Coons log cabin back in the United States. And now Katie King shows up again here at this particular seance. When this spirit, who called herself Katie King, reached William Volkman, who was sitting at this seance, who was a lawyer, he suddenly reached out and took a firm grip on her hand. And then he threw his arms around her to contain her. Someone quickly doused the small gas jet, and very strong masculine hands yanked the spirit out of Volkman's arms. When finally the gas jet was lighted again and the curtain was drawn aside, Katie King was gone, and Florence Cook was found tied to her chair as before. Volkman was immediately ejected from the room, while the sympathetic sitters rushed over to comfort the distraught medium. 2 weeks later, in an article in a spiritualist magazine, see, Volkman himself was a spiritualist. 2 weeks later, Volkman explained his actions by stating, quote, "Having for 40 minutes carefully observed and scrutinized the face, features, gestures, size, style, and peculiarities of utterance of the so-called spirit, the conviction irresistibly forced itself upon me that no ghost but the medium Miss Florence Cook herself was walking around before the audience." Florence Cook went to William Crookes to be tested by him, and he endorsed her as genuine. In 1874, Crookes invited another teenage medium, Mary Showers, to his laboratory. The spirit Mary produced was named Florence. Crookes invited both Florence Cook, the other medium, and Mary Showers to a joint seance. And their spirits, Katie King and Florence, appeared from behind the curtain after the two mediums had gone into trance. They walked around the dimly lit laboratory with their arms entwined, the two spirits, and they cavorted somewhat like schoolgirls. Edward W. Cox, a lawyer and a friend of Crookes, suggested that the curtain be left open while the two spirits walked around the room so that the mediums who were allegedly in trance could be seen at the same time, that the spirits were walking around the room. Then he said there could be no doubt that no deception had taken place. But William Crookes would not permit that safeguard to be observed. However, at another seance conducted by Mary Showers alone now, not along with Florence Cook, Edward Cox was again present when the alleged spirit Florence put her shroud-covered head through the opening in the drape. The medium was in a chair, supposedly entranced behind the curtain, and the drape was pulled slightly aside, and the spirit put her head through the opening. A curious woman sitter, who apparently didn't know protocol, pulled the curtain aside, only to reveal that the chair in which the medium had been sitting in a trance was empty. And the medium herself, wearing this ghostly headdress, was standing up against the other side of the curtain. The medium's eyes, which up to that point had been rolled back, the medium's eyes quickly came down, focused upon this interrupting woman who had made this blunder. And the medium tried desperately to grab the curtain and pull the drapes together again. And in the struggle, the ghost headdress toppled off and fell down on the floor. The spirit shrieked, "You have killed my medium!" Edward Cox reported dryly that the medium did not lose her life, just some of her composure. William Crookes, in spite of this obvious fraud, continued to seek for proof that spirits survive physical death and can communicate with the living through mediums. Yet on August 1st, 1874, he wrote a letter to a woman in St. Petersburg, and he stated this. Now, he had tested many mediums by this time, including the most celebrated medium in England, Daniel Douglas Hume, besides these others that he had tested. And he wrote these words: "To fix the identity of a deceased person has been the chief object I have had before me for the last 3 or 4 years, and I have neglected no opportunity myself on that point. I had almost unlimited opportunities of investigation, more so than perhaps any other man in Europe. For 6 months, Kate Fox, one of the Fox sisters, was giving seances at my home once or twice a week. And since Christmas last, Miss Cook has been almost one of the family, being here more than at her parents' house, and giving tests and seances several times a week. In addition to these highly gifted mediums, I have had frequent seances with all the other good mediums whose names are familiar to spiritualists. During this whole time, I have most earnestly desired to get the one proof you seek, the proof that the dead can return and communicate. I have never once had satisfactory proof that this is the case. I know how earnestly the soul craves for one little sign of life beyond the grave." Incidentally, this letter, which was written in 1874, was not made public until May 12, 1900, in the London Weekly Light. Whether it was suppressed or whether it was simply did not come to light is a question for speculation. But this is the verdict of perhaps the most celebrated investigator in Great Britain of spiritualistic phenomenon, a member of the Royal Academy, a man who was a highly respected member of the scientific community. And he said, after all of his investigations, "I have never once had satisfactory proof that this is the case." 6 months after the death of his own wife, in 1916, William Crookes had a seance with a man named William Hope, a spirit photographer. on one of the plates that Crookes brought with him and was permitted to develop himself, some words addressed to his friend Sir Oliver Lodge appeared on the plate. On another plate, an unmistakable likeness of Crookes' dead wife appeared besides the picture of himself. So on the plate there was a picture of Crookes and beside him an unmistakable likeness of his dead wife. Here, Crookes said, he had finally found definite proof of survival. And he wrote Sir Oliver that this communication had lessened his sorrow over the loss of his wife. Lodge replied that he had found hope to be unworthy of trust. Crookes sent a print of the photograph to the Ghost Club. The Ghost Club was a group of very highly respected men who met from time to time and believed in survival after death. And he sent this a print stating that he considered it unimpeachable evidence that his wife had survived death. And he added that he had heard her voice requesting that he send the Ghost Club this print. This print, by the way, is still on display today at the College of Psychic Studies in London. This very print with his picture and this likeness of his dead wife. 5 years later, and 3 years after Crookes' own death, William Hope, this spirit photographer, came to London for a series of seances. On February 24, 1922, Harry Price, a professional magician, a member of the London Circle, a member of the Society of American Magicians, Harry Price came to the College of Psychic Science for a sitting with this medium, William Hope. Price brought with him a box of four photographic plates, which had been secretly marked by the manufacturer of the plates using an X-ray technique with a picture of a lion with the word imperial underneath the lion. And this symbol would show up only when the plates were developed. It could not be detected before that time. Following some hymns and prayer, Hope escorted Price into a dark room where he told Price, Harry Price the magician, to insert two of his plates into a camera slide. This was one of the big old cameras, you know, when you put slides in and out. Hope then took the slide and he told Price to close and tie the box containing the other two plates. Unlike the usual sitter, Price did not look down as he closed and tied the box of plates. Price was a magician. Price knew the method of indirection. He knew that. And so instead of looking down as he closed the box and tied the ribbon, he kept his eyes right on William Hope, the spirit photographer. There was just enough light, a very dim red light, for Price to see Hope step back, turn partially around, and switch the loaded slide with another loaded slide which had been in the upper left-hand pocket of his coat. Hope placed the slide in the camera in the next room. They went into the next room and he arranged Price for a sitting. And Price posed for him. And Price was permitted to develop the plates himself. Now think of it. Price was allowed to bring the plates. Think of it. Price was allowed to develop the plates. No deception possible there. Sure enough, on one of the plates, there was a woman's face next to Price's own face on the photographic plate. However, the lion emblem of the photographic firm did not appear on either plate. Later, Price and two members of the Society for Psychical Research, in fact, the research secretary, Eric Dingwall, was one of them, took the two unused plates in the box of four to a reputed photographic studio and allowed the photographer to develop them independently. The lion emblem with the word imperial appeared quite clearly on these two other plates. William Hope had obviously made an earlier exposure of part of one of the plates to produce the alleged spirit picture. It was a simple case of a double exposure. And that was first introduced by an American photographer named William Mumler, who started this whole thing going of spirit photography using double exposures. An account of this whole investigation by Harry Price was published in the May 1922 issue of the Journal of the Society of Psychical Research. But you already begin to see the way this thing is going. But you haven't seen the way it's going to come out yet with the Fox sisters, because that is absolute dynamite. However, now we come back to the United States and back to Philadelphia, no less. In Philadelphia, the Seibert Commission was set up to test all persons who claimed to be able to transmit messages from the dead. A man named Henry Seibert, S-E-Y-B-E-R-T, a Philadelphia philanthropist and spiritualist, shortly before his death in the year 1883, offered the University of Pennsylvania $60,000, which in 1883 was no small sum, to establish a chair of moral and intellectual philosophy, that is, to endow a professorship, and to have a faculty committee investigate the truth of modern spiritualism. $60,000. A blue ribbon committee chaired by Dr. Horace Howard Furness investigated, first of all, Mrs. S.E. Patterson of Philadelphia, a medium who specialized in receiving spirit messages on slates, a simple child's slate. Only this was usually double and hinged. And Mrs. Patterson specialized in getting messages from spirits who wrote with chalk or soapstone on these slates. The way the procedure went, people would come to her and would ask from her a message from someone. And so Mrs. Patterson would take this hinged double slate and she would put it under a table. And the other person would sit on the other side of the table. And then, after a little short while of waiting and maybe some praying, there would be the sound of some scratching on the slate. And after the sound of the scratching would end, Mrs. Patterson would take the slate out and open it up, and there would be a message to the person. And it was on the inside of the slate, that is, the double slates that would be hinged and enclosed. So it would be on the inside. And, of course, this was regarded as being an evidence of messages from the... How else, I mean, could it be done? Well, and she was a local medium, quite famous in the Philadelphia area. But then Henry Slade, he just happened to be named Slade, S-L-A-D-E, Henry Slade of New York, who was the most famous slate medium in the world at that time, he came before the Seibert Commission and was thoroughly investigated. He showed phenomena which really mystified the Seibert Commission members, the University of Pennsylvania faculty members on the Seibert Commission committee. What usually happened with Henry Slade was he would not only take the slates and close them, but then would take red sealing wax and seal the two edges together so that you could not open the slates without breaking the sealing wax. And then he would put the slate under the table, basically work the same procedure, under the table. And then the commission members would be usually one commission member at a time sitting across from him at a table. And then he would hold the slate under the table, and then there would be this scratching sound again. The spirit would be communicating message. It was interesting that when the Spirit wanted to communicate a long message and Mr. Slade would bring it out and open it up, break the seal and open it up, the long message from the Spirit would be written rather nicely in a nice hand, quite legible, quite good handwriting. And those were prepared questions submitted by the commission members ahead of time. But whenever the commission members submitted questions on the spot, that is, right at the time of the attempt at getting an answer from, messages were usually very short and hardly legible. So there was some question as to why the Spirit's handwriting style would change so radically as between long messages or short messages. Well, at the time of the sitting of the commission, a man named Harry Keller, K-E-L-L-A-R, who was one of the most famous magicians of that time, Harry Keller happened to be performing in the city. And one of the commission members, learning that Harry Keller was in the city, invited Harry Keller over to sit with the commission and to give any comments that he wished to make about this great man, Henry Slade, or any comment that he would like to make about how he evaluated what was going on. Well, Harry Keller asked the commission members to bring their own slates. They brought their own slates. Harry Keller told them to seal the slates themselves with sealing wax. And then Harry Keller took the slates one by one, put them under the table. The scratching sound of the Spirit hand was heard again each time. And Harry Keller produced messages in English, Spanish, French, Chinese, Gujarati, and Japanese for the commission members. And in full view of the commission members, that is, they couldn't see under the table, but in daylight, with no lights out, nothing of that sort, and he produced nice, legible writing in six languages for the commission members and thoroughly mystified them. But then, of course, after his demonstration, Keller was also one who went after mediums. Keller then explained how he did it to the commission members. And he explained how Henry Slade could easily have done what he did. Whenever there were questions submitted previously and there were longer answers in good legible handwriting, he said Slade simply switched the slates. That's all it was. Simply a switching of the slates, switching one slate for another. And then Keller let them in on one or two of his professional secrets as to how the switching was done. Whenever Slade was given a question right at the time, Slade had palmed a bit of soapstone in his hand so that no one could see it. Any magician can palm any number of things and no one can see it. And Slade simply palmed it, and simply underneath there, he scratched on the message, which was very illegible, a short answer, and thus, but then someone said, but wait a minute, when there was a long answer from the Spirit, we also heard the Spirit scratching. And Harry Keller just took one of the slates and put it under, and he started to make the scratching with his fingernail. And he said, that's how the Spirit scratched with the longer message. Well, it just, of course, blew their minds as to... But he did it in six languages, and he showed them that it was a simple magic trick. They also investigated Margaret Fox Kane, one of the Fox sisters, who had married the Arctic explorer Elisha Kent Kane in a common law ceremony, and they also took on all other psychic comers who wanted to appear before the Seibert Commission. Finally, the commission reported that they, quote, had not been cheered by the discovery of a single novel fact, which is a very clever... They only offered, by the way, $500 for anyone who could produce mediumistic phenomena. However, in the September 24th, 1888 edition of the New York Herald, and by the way, in a lot of large libraries, you know, they have newspapers on microfilm. And you could go back in some of these newspaper files and get out the microfilm and put it on a microfilm machine and then read the actual story itself. If you knew the date, this is September 24th, 1888, and it's the New York Herald. It's really a lot of fun to read old newspapers, to read, for instance, the front page of the sinking of the Titanic, when that news first came. It's absolutely fascinating. And all this material, or a lot of it, is preserved on microfilm so that you can read it for yourself in large libraries that have the equipment as well as the files. A sensational story appeared in that issue, which cheered the anti-spiritualist forces and dismayed the true spiritualist believers. What was this sensational story that appeared? Margaret Fox had given an interview to a Herald reporter in which she told the story of the beginnings of spiritualism. She recalled how she and Kate had tied a string to an apple and bounced the apple on the floor by their bed late at night to make the first spirit raps. When members of the community came to their house to witness the strange goings on, the girls obviously could not tie strings and bounce apples on the floor with the people right there in the room. So they discovered a new way to produce noises by snapping their toes against the lower end of their wooden bed. The lower end of the wooden bed acted as a sounding board. Margaret Fox told how Leah, their much older sister, found out about the little fun that they were having and saw possibilities in it. And Margaret told how Leah began taking one or both of them, either Margaret or Kate, on exhibition and making money from these exhibitions. Margaret said, quote, "When spiritualism first began, Kate and I were little children, and this old woman, my older sister, made us her tools." She was actually 23 years older. Leah was 23 years older than Kate at the time. "We were but innocent little children. What did we know?" The reporter from the Herald asked her, as Margaret took him to the door, she said, "Absolutely." And gazing into space, she posed her own question. "Spirits, is he not easily fooled?" And three raps of confirmation sounded on the door, which got him a little bit got him a little bit nervous. Newsmen hurried to try to get Leah's side of the story, but they were told that by her maid that she had suddenly left town, and no one knew when she would return. Margaret then announced that she would show the public at the New York Academy of Music on Sunday evening, October 21st, 1888, how she and her sisters had been cheating all along. Well, that announcement was dynamite. The Academy of Music, this is not the Philadelphia Academy, but the New York Academy of Music, was jammed for the highly publicized exposure. Remember, this is October 21st, 1888. There were as many spiritualist believers as skeptics in the audience. There were a lot of people turned away, of course. In the preliminary portion of the program, first a magician and then a stage manager demonstrated and explained to the audience how messages appeared on blank slates and how tables tilted in seances. The spiritualist believers in the audience vented their disapproval with hisses and groans. A murmur swept the auditorium as the major attraction, Margaret Fox, dressed entirely in black, came on stage from the wings. She was so nervous, it was reported, that she could not speak distinctly enough to be heard. So she slipped off her right shoe and put her foot on a wooden stool. In the words of the report which appeared in the New York World, all of the New York papers, by the way, reported this, you can imagine. In the words of this report, the entire house became breathlessly still and was rewarded by a number of little, short, sharp raps, those mysterious sounds which have for 40 years frightened and bewildered hundreds of thousands of people in this country and Europe. End quote. Margaret's sister, Kate, sat in a box adjacent to the stage that night. Less than 2 weeks before, Kate had stated in print, quote, "Spiritualism is a humbug from beginning to end. It is the greatest humbug of the century." End quote. That's quite a statement from Kate Fox. Margaret then put her foot on top of a low stand, which was a sounding board and would magnify the rapping noises. Looking at the back of the crowded hall, she created the illusion that the famous raps were coming from the back of the hall. And then, by directing her eyes first to the walls and then to the stand itself, she made it appear that the raps followed her gaze. And she did that by making the raps progressively louder and louder as she looked from distance closer and closer down to the stand itself. Two doctors who had volunteered to study the movements of Margaret's foot came forward, examined her foot, and publicly admitted that they could see no movement. They could see no movement while the raps were being made. Even though Margaret confessed that she was snapping her big toe, when the doctors touched her foot, they could feel the muscular movement near the first joint of her big toe. After her appearance at the New York Academy of Music, Margaret went on tour, climaxing a magic show presented by Elmer P. Ransom in Realistic Phenomena. Each night, Margaret put her foot on a sounding board and demonstrated how she made the rapping noises. Incidentally, Ransom's wife learned how to snap her big toe in exactly the same way. Years later, Milbourne Christopher, the professional magician, asked Elmer Ransom how Margaret had caused the raps to sound on walls and on doors. Ransom said, "Women wore floor-length dresses in those days. She pulled her right foot from her shoe under the cover of her dress, then bent her leg so her foot touched the wall or door as she stood before it, facing the sitters. Then she snapped her toe and made the raps appear to come not from her, but from the door or from the walls." The scandal caused by these exposures and confessions shook spiritualism. But by the time the three Fox sisters died, Leah in 1890, Kate in 1892, and Margaret in 1893, the movement had become too well established to be destroyed by allegations or admissions of fraud. Spiritualism had become worldwide in the nearly 50 years since the first rappings at Hydesville, and many other spirit mediums had appeared to take their place.
One of the most outstanding mediums in spiritualist history was Daniel Dunglass Hume. He was born in Scotland in 1833. He was brought by his aunt to America at the age of 9, where he lived in Greenville, Connecticut, and Troy, New York. When Daniel was 17, rappings began to occur in his presence. His aunt thought he was demon-possessed and called in Congregationalist, Baptist, and Methodist ministers to cast out the demon. But when they failed to do so, she turned the boy out of the house. Daniel Hume found a world of people eager to offer him shelter and to test his psychic powers. He began to hold seances and to allow himself to be tested by committees. He prided himself on never accepting money for either the seances or for the tests before these committees. Although he did permit his admirers to pay for travel and living expenses and to present him with expensive jewels, he traveled all over Europe and enthralled his small seance audiences. He never gave demonstrations before large public audiences. He never gave demonstrations before more than, say, 12 people. And he traveled in England, France, Italy, Prussia, Holland, and Russia. He performed before the crowned heads of a couple of these countries. However, although he amazed thousands of persons over his lifetime, in his seances, his performances before investigating committees were rather disappointing, especially those that were held under rather tightly controlled conditions. Of course, precautions against the possibility of fraud, precautions were rarely taken at Hume's seances. And most of the people who witnessed the seances would not have known what to look for in terms of fraud, or perhaps where to look for it would be a more accurate way of putting it. Various reports about Hume's performances in seances include the following phenomena. Now listen to this cataloging of the phenomena that he produced, or reportedly produced, in his lifetime. Tables levitated while people sat on them. He would have six people sit on a table and the table would rise up and rock. Bells flew around the room. Spirit hands appeared, just the hands, no arms, just the hands, and sometimes touched or shook hands with the sitters in the seances. Pianos floated, sometimes while the pianists were playing them. For instance, in Italy, Countess Orsini was playing a classic piece, and the piano levitated. She kept right on playing. She had to stand up off the seat, but she kept on playing. Chandeliers gyrated. Concertinas, we call them today accordions, concertinas held at only one end played melodies, only at one end. Handkerchiefs floated around. Armchairs cantered around the room. Fireballs wandered about the room, sometimes passing right through solid objects. Drafts of air howled about the room when all the doors and windows were shut. Doors opened and closed themselves. Flowers fell down from the ceiling. Deceased persons materialized, sometimes in rather solid bodies. Hume himself floated around like a balloon, sometimes right up to the ceiling. Once it is reported that the window was open just 1 foot on the third story, and that he floated out the window head first and then appeared at another window knocking from the outside, standing on a narrow sill asking them to let him in. Hume elongated his body, standing against a wall with a mark on the wall, from 5 feet 10 inches to 6 feet 6 inches, while one man held his feet, another held his waist, and another stood closely and watched his head. And Hume, later on in his life, developed a very dramatic phenomenon. He began handling live coals. He would go over to a fireplace filled with live coals, and he would pick them up in his bare hands. The coals were so hot that people could not stand the heat from 6 inches away. And when he laid the coals down on a piece of paper, the paper would burst immediately into flames. And he would walk around carrying these live coals with apparently no effect whatsoever. Hume died in 1886. He is said to be the only medium never detected in a fraud over quite a number of years. Now, you'll hear that statement quite often if you read in the occult literature, if you read about spiritualism. He is the only medium never detected in a fraud.
Which says a certain amount about all the other mediums.
Of course, he didn't have people like Harry Keller or Harry Price or Harry Houdini going after him either, which would have, I think, made an interesting difference. Incidentally, and I must add, after having cataloged all of these wonders, all of the wonders which D.D. Hume produced were duplicated many, many times by professional magicians on stages around the world. They have been done many, many times. All of these things, by the way, I just said. Of course, true spiritualist believers said that mediums did them by spirit powers, whereas magicians did them by mere trickery and deception. And that is the explanation that is given. Hereward Carrington, the first man to devote his life to psychical research in the United States. He devoted his life to investigating psychic phenomena. Hereward Carrington was invited in 1908 to be part of a team formed to conduct test sittings with the most famous and controversial medium in Europe at the time. And this was Eusebia Palladino. At the conclusion of the team's 11th sitting with Palladino, the testers unanimously agreed that they had observed supernormal phenomena, phenomena beyond human explanation. A table, for instance, had levitated. Strange forms had materialized. Objects had moved, apparently on their own volition. In November of 1909, the 54-year-old medium, Eusebia Palladino, arrived in New York to give a series of seances under Carrington's management. Again, she produced the amazing phenomena while sitters on either side of her held both her hands and her feet. You say, how could they do that? They have forearms? No. The sitter on her left would hold her left hand with his right hand and would put his right foot on her left foot on top of it. And then the sitter on the right hand would do the same. Hold a hand with a hand, put a foot on top of her other foot so that she couldn't move her feet and couldn't move her hands. She couldn't do anything. And yet she produced all of these phenomena with her hands and her feet held. In the February 1910 issue of Metropolitan Magazine, Professor Hugo Minsterberg of Harvard University reported that in one of the seances with Palladino, a sitter had slipped from his chair in the almost dark room. Her seances were conducted in a room which had one small red lamp and very, very dim. It was very difficult to see anything in the room, just a little bit. But one of the sitters had slipped from his chair and had sprawled on the floor behind the medium's chair. When a stool moved noisily, he reached out to make sure that there was no string attached to the stool, which was making it move. And instead, he grabbed Eusapia's foot. Somehow, she had freed her foot, even at the very time her adjacent sitters thought that they had both her feet under their control. But he grabbed her foot. That was a little embarrassing, of course. But that was reported in Metropolitan Magazine in February 1910. But the most damaging of many exposures of Eusapia Palladino appeared in the March 4th, 1910 issue of Collier's Weekly. March 4th, 1910. Dr. Joseph Jastrow reported that two of his colleagues, clad completely in black coveralls, had crept into the room in which a Palladino seance was in progress and had positioned themselves under the table. In the semi-darkness, they saw the medium's foot strike a table leg to produce raps. As Eusapia tilted the table to the right with her right hand, they saw her put her left foot under the left table leg. She tilted the table to the right so that the left leg would rise. Then she put her left foot under the left table leg. Pressing down now with her left hand on the top of the table and up with her left foot under the table leg, she formed a clamp between her hand and her foot, and she lifted her left foot and she levitated the table from the floor. Ridiculed by feature writers, censured by editorials, and caricatured by cartoonists, Eusapia Palladino left New York very quickly after this exposure to return to Italy. And it was discovered that shortly after she arrived back in Italy that she had lost most of her mediumistic powers. Now you may wonder how a person whose hands and feet were being held, how such a person could free her hands or free her feet. Without going into too much detail, Houdini showed how this could be very simply and easily done. Here is a sitter sitting to my left. Here is a sitter sitting to my right. It's a very dark room. You can hardly see anything. What happened was that first the medium would move her hand with the hand of the sitter so that it would be almost immediately in front of her. Then she would move the hand of the sitter here so that she could put her hand on both hands, the hand of the sitter over here and the hand of the sitter over here. And then she had the other hand free with which to work. And then she slipped, she wore high shoes, she slipped her foot out of her shoe. And it was apparently a stiff shoe, so that her sitter thought he had his foot on top of her foot when he had his foot on top of her shoe. And then she had her foot free to work as well. So now she had a hand free and a foot. The next thing that she did, as Houdini so cleverly again and again showed as to how this all could be done, the next thing which she did was she got the sitter's hand to her left and the sitter's hand to her right and got them to hold each other's hand. Now she had both hands free. Well, you could see that the possibilities are almost endless as to what one could do with a little imagination. And that is precisely what was done. In December 1922, Scientific American magazine, one of the most prestigious magazines here in the country, stated that on the basis of existing data, it could not reach a definite conclusion as to the validity of psychic claims. So the magazine announced two awards of $2,500 each.
One, for the first person to take an authentic spirit photograph under test conditions. The other, for the first medium to produce an authentic, visible psychic manifestation. Five eminent men were chosen as judges for the contest. Dr. William McDougall, professor of psychology at Harvard. Dr. Daniel Fisk Comstock, a former member of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's physics department. Dr. Walter Franklin Prince, research officer of the American Society for Psychical Research. Hereward Carrington, investigator of paranormal phenomena. And Harry Houdini, the magician. From the time the awards were announced until the final report of the committee in February 1925, five contenders came forward to claim the prizes. The first was Elizabeth Allen Thompson, a professional psychic with a flourishing business in Chicago. However, she and her husband refused to submit to being tested under strict conditions and thus withdrew from contention. It should be mentioned that Mrs. Thompson had been investigated by Sir Hiram Maxim, an inventor, in London in 1910. She had been exposed as a gross fraud and had broken into tears and confessed that she was not a medium or even a spiritualist. The second who came forward was George Valentin of Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania.
George Valentin, who staged his seances in the dark. Spirit voices spoke from a spirit trumpet. Now, a spirit trumpet is just like a megaphone. It's usually about this long. It doesn't open up into a bell. It's just a simple, rather narrow megaphone. One end is about this large. The other end is about this large. A spirit trumpet. And spirit voices spoke out of a spirit trumpet. The spirit trumpet floated about the room. Sitters reported that they had been touched by invisible hands. The medium, unfortunately, did not know that his chair had been wired and connected by wire in an adjoining room to a light which flashed each time he left the chair. Now, he did not know that. The flashes of light were timed by an investigator with a stopwatch. And each spirit manifestation in the next room was also timed very precisely. The investigators discovered that every time a phenomenon occurred, the medium was out of his chair. So that finished that particular medium's chances for the prize. The third contender was the Reverend Josie K. Stewart of Cleveland, who produced messages from the dead on previously examined pieces of blank cardboard and did so in the broad daylight. This was a new twist. Her first test in the Scientific American offices was a failure. She tried again 2 days later, apparently noticing that each of the committee's cards, see, the committee provided the cards, noticing that each one of the committee's cards had been marked by a pinprick at one corner, she failed again. At the third sitting, the cards were once again marked by a slight trimming of one of the corners on each of the cards, and Reverend Josie failed again. However, at the fourth sitting, spirit messages began to come through. She held the pack in the air, went into a series of mild convulsions, fell back into her chair, and cried out, "Look at the cards! Look at the cards!" Sure enough, three of the cards carried inscriptions apparently written by a ghostly hand. After a brief interval in which the medium regained her composure and then rose and once again held the cards in the air, two more mysterious communications appeared. Now five cards had messages on them. The next morning, Josie reported that her spirit guide, Effie, had told her during the previous night that she would win the prize. Effie, however, was wrong. Upon examination, it was discovered that the five cards on which the messages had appeared were longer, were of a thinner card stock, and of a slightly different color than the cards the magazine had supplied for the experiment. In addition, Dr. Prince, the member of the committee from the ASPR, had spotted the move Josie had made in switching the cards. And that, of course, ended her chances for the prize. The fourth contender was a young Italian. Are you getting the impression that this is shot through and through with fraud? I hope you're getting that impression. The fourth contender was a young Italian medium, Nino Pecoraro. He had astounded none other than Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes. Pecoraro claimed that his spirit guide was, guess, Eusebia Palladino, who had died in 1918. In a previous seance with the Doyles, Sir Arthur and his wife, with Hereward Carrington and with seven other sitters, the table levitated, and then Pecoraro went into a trance. Carrington tied the medium's legs and hands to his chair with picture wire, and then the chair was pushed back into a cabinet. Spirit mediums usually worked inside some kind of a cabinet. Frequently the cabinet was just made by a folding screen. A screen that folded, had a back and then sides, and then a curtain was drawn usually across the front. And that formed the cabinet inside which the spirit medium worked. Well, the chair in which Pecoraro had been tied was pushed back into the cabinet, and the curtains were drawn. Shortly thereafter, the curtains across the front of the cabinet blew forward, the table vibrated and shook, a cool breeze was felt by the Doyles, a tambourine jangled and then appeared in front of the cabinet, a handbell rang, a child's piano tinkled inside the cabinet, and a small table came through the opening in the curtains and crashed to the floor.